Well, the door's closed, so I think we've got the signal to start. If I could get your attention, please. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Mark Baxter. I'm the Chief Risk Officer of Wealth Management Division of CBA, and I'm chairing the session today on systemic risk management and implications for insurers. Anthony and Jacob from Mercer Oliver Wyman will actually be running the session today. We'll have about 20 minutes of a presentation from them, and then open the floor to questions. And if I can just quickly introduce both Anthony. Anthony's right here. Anthony's a partner at Mercer Oliver Wyman in Sydney and leads the insurance and wealth practice in Asia Pacific. Prior to coming to Sydney in 2009, he was based in London, where he led Oliver Wyman's insurance financial effectiveness practice for Europe and Africa. Anthony has worked in depth with major insurance groups across the globe, specialising in the measurement and management of risk, capital and value. And his most recent focus has actually been to help leading insurers and wealth managers in enhancing their risk management frameworks. Anthony joined Oliver Wyman in 2004, having spent 9 years with a major actuarial consultancy in London and Sydney. And prior to that, he worked for 2 years with AMP, like a lot of actuarial people. he got a first-class honours degree in economics from the ANU, and he received a university medal and is a fellow of both the Institute of Actuaries of Australia and Institute of Actuaries of the UK. Jacob, on my far left, is also a partner at Mercer Oliver Wyman, where he leads the public policy practice across the Asia Pacific. Jacob's area of expertise includes financial sector regulation and development of policy, institutional banking and capital markets and asset management. He has extensive experience consulting to leading financial sector institutions across the Asia Pacific and worked in Mercer Oliver Wyman's Singapore office for 5 years before transferring to Australia. So in Anthony and Jacob, we have an enormous amount of international experience, and they've seen what a lot of wealth managers are doing around the globe in respect of risk management. Jacob holds a BA Honours in Political Science from Victoria University in New Zealand and an MA in International Finance and Banking from the Fletcher School, Tufts University. He's the author of a number of reports on financial services sector in Asia Pacific. And I'll hand over to Anthony and Jacob.
Thank you, Mark. I'll take this one.
Good afternoon, everybody. Today we are going to talk about the topic of systemic risk management, what it is, how governments, regulators, the private sector are responding to it, and what it means for the insurance and wealth management industry. So I'm going to begin by addressing the question first, what is systemic risk and what is going on in the regulatory world in response to the heightened awareness of the systemic risk issue that we've seen following the global financial crisis. And then I'll hand over to Anthony, who will talk in more detail around what this means for the insurance industry and how the industry is thinking about responding to what's going on. So let me first try to address the question of what is systemic risk. So this is clearly a topic which is much discussed these days. There is a great deal of thought and activity going on in the public sphere, in the academic world, within the institutions and the private sector, where people are trying to grapple with the question of systemic risk. It's clear that we have a problem with it or recently experienced its negative consequences, but there are a lot of different definitions out there for what systemic risk is and how people should think about it. So what we would like to begin with is setting out how we like to think about systemic risk. So we think of systemic risk as the risk of the financial system not being able to perform its required functions. And that's, in particular, not being able to perform it under times of stress and strain and difficulty in the financial markets and in the economy. So what do we mean by this? First, let's have a look at what we mean by the financial system. How do we think about the components of that? We break this out into the institutions, the banks, insurance companies, et cetera, that operate in the sector, into the infrastructure, which is not only the nuts and bolts of the markets and the payment systems, but also the legal infrastructure that supports the sector, as well as the markets themselves. So these are the key components in our view, and the functions which they need to be able to perform in good times and bad, allocation of resources across the economy, maturity transformation, bringing borrowers and lenders together with and dealing with their different needs, providing risk management capabilities and an ability to price and transfer risk, and finally enabling efficient transactions to keep the wheels of the economy running. So these are all the things that we expect a financial sector to do, and generally we interpret systemic risk as anything on the left-hand side here amongst these institutions, the infrastructure or the markets, that causes a problem that threatens the effective functioning of the system as a whole and has negative externalities for the real economy and for the other parts of the financial sector. So that's broadly what we think about systemic risk as. Now it's probably helpful to highlight a bit how we think this can play out. What are the different types of systemic risk that we see in the world, and how have we seen those playing out over the last few years? If we look across those three categories of institutions, infrastructure, and markets, institutions is a relatively clear and obvious one. Clearly, the GFC was a problem in many respects with financial risks faced by the key institutions, particularly in the banking sector. So these are the traditional credit market liquidity risk and so forth. Obviously, there are other major non-financial risks that face these types of institutions, to do with operational failures, fraud, and legal trouble. But all of those are certainly things that are relatively well known and thought about and came out clearly in dramatic fashion during the financial crisis. Infrastructure is perhaps a little less discussed. So there are significant risks, some of which were demonstrated during the GFC and some of which have not yet materialized in any significant way around the functioning of financial infrastructure. So there are risks to the nuts and bolts, the systems that underlie payments and transactions within the financial sector, the operational risks of these entities breaking down. But there are also risks that the legal infrastructure in which all of the financial system sits may sometimes exacerbate and cause more trouble in the financial markets than may have been anticipated. So certainly issues like fair value accounting questions and what that meant for valuations and the way in which that exacerbated some of the aspects of the crisis are relevant there, as well as questions of the legal framework around bankruptcy and resolution, which we saw in the case of the Lehman Brothers default, was not sufficiently robust to ensure full effectiveness of that part of the system. And then finally, clearly there are risks in the markets, obvious ones around contagion, runs on markets, and also the types of risks that exist in the marketplaces which before the crisis weren't perhaps thought about as enough given the importance that they played, such as counterparty risk. So this is broadly what we see as the types of risks out there. And when we think about the response to systemic risk, we have assessed each of those different categories of risk, the institutions, infrastructure, and markets, and tried to make an assessment as to the key risks out there. To what degree are they really being sufficiently addressed by the regulatory agenda and the public dialogue that we see in the world today? So this page here has three columns. First is the key risks that we think are broadly addressed in the regulatory dialogue. It doesn't mean that the perfect answer has been found, but these are high on the agenda and are being thought through, and we are likely to have a regulatory solution to them relatively soon. Then there are risks which are somewhat discussed but probably not as sufficiently nailed down and resolved as would be ideal. And finally, there are a number of key risks out there that we think are not really being addressed at all or not really discussed enough. So what we've seen over the last year, obviously, is a migration of topics from the right-hand side to the left-hand side. Clearly, there's an awful lot that has been going on and a great deal of improvement to covering up the gaps in the global regulatory architecture that we see. So a few examples there. Obviously, capital was a major issue. arbitrage between different types of financial institutions, between banks and insurers, with different types of capital rules, arbitrage between off and on balance sheet activities, and arbitrage between within the banking sector, different types of the banking book. All of this was problematic, but is being addressed as part of the proposals that we see coming out under Basel III and Solvency II. Likewise, liquidity risk was under-addressed and now is certainly on the agenda. And if you look to infrastructure, there's been good improvement in terms of the framework around credit ratings, or around accounting, and also in the markets, an awful lot going on around bringing more transparency to over-the-counter trading in the capital markets. So great progress there in terms of general closing of regulatory gaps, but we do still see a number of areas where we think more thought is required in terms of the policy response. So there remain big questions around financial conglomerates, the degree to which they are interconnected with each other, interconnected across different parts of the conglomerate, interconnected across different subsectors and parts of the financial world. So there's thinking going on and regulatory dialogue in terms of the living wills initiatives that we see in the United Kingdom, which are requiring financial institutions to think through how they can decompose themselves, how they can reduce the risk of contagion from one part of a conglomerate to another, building firewalls between them. This process is yet to play out. We don't know exactly what the rules will look like, but there's certainly likely to be something which addresses this at least partially. Another area that we think is under-addressed is non-bank financial institutions, so the wholesale funded lenders that we saw a lot before the crisis. These entities, these business models, that they were built for a falling rates environment, so clearly they're not particularly attractive at the moment, particularly given the way wholesale markets feel about these business models. But all of the regulatory action on the lending side has been focused on regulated banks, and there's a big empty space there that when the markets change, when appetite returns for that type of risk, that there is a possibility that we'll have a lot of unregulated activity. And the attempts that we're making across financial services to clamp down on certain types of risk-taking will result in risk-taking popping up in other areas of the overall sector. A few more things I'll quickly mention. We think that the questions around the ownership and the soundness of critical infrastructure to the market, such as clearinghouses and central counterparties, which are becoming more important as more trading activity moves onto them, that we feel that there's not yet sufficient attention to the risks that are facing these institutions, and that's both on the operational side and as well. We think that there are risks around contagion in terms of ownership of these by broad conglomerates. So a number of other things there as well that we think are perhaps half finished, and we see additional activity coming in the regulatory space. A few things we'd just briefly highlight that we think aren't at all addressed. The question of the financial activities of corporations, so the sales and trading activities of a energy company, for example, and present some significant interesting risks that don't fall within any regulatory regime. Country risk concentrations across an entire system. I think we've seen this in great dramatic detail over the last couple of weeks. We have financial systems in Europe which are heavily exposed to the financial systems of other countries. And whilst regulators have been looking at this at an institution level, nobody's been looking at it at a systemic level, and the build-ups have happened unnoticed. A few other areas there, large underfunded pension funds we think are potentially going to cause significant disruption in the markets. There's a gap of about $1 to $2 trillion in pension fund funding for the defined benefit schemes globally. And finally, there's the question at the bottom there of asset price bubble. So the orthodoxy in terms of economic management and monetary policy has generally been to focus on rates and growth and inflation, and not to focus on asset prices. But I think there's a gap there in terms of a lack of systemic regulatory attention to that point. So moving quickly along then, beyond all of these different risks that we see out there that are being addressed to different extents, there's the question of how well the regulatory community is responding to the question of who takes ownership for monitoring all of these risks across the system. And broadly, there's a need to build out national and international level accountabilities for looking at systemic risk. There's been some progress. You can see interesting initiatives coming out in the United Kingdom and in the US for addressing the national level question, but internationally there's still very little coordination and very little move towards any sort of an integrated early warning system for systemic risk. Now, the final point I'll make here before handing over to Anthony to talk more deeply about insurance is that I think what's interesting for financial institutions in a lot of this discussion of systemic risk is the question of, are you, as an institution, a systemic risk? Are you systemically relevant? Because that has significant implications for the way in which the institution is likely to be treated by regulators going forward. And most of those implications are negative. So certainly, being systemically relevant will be result in different treatment in a crisis, and that's a positive thing because you're more likely to be rescued. But in business as usual conditions, there will be a quid pro quo for that that support, be it explicit or implicit, and that quid pro quo will be around greater scrutiny over activities, potentially greater capital requirements, potential directives to dismantle certain activities. So all of this can have significant implications for the financial sector. Now, there's clearly a lot of dialogue around this, and a lot of it has been very banking-focused. Obviously, the crisis was predominantly a banking crisis, and it has informed a lot of the thinking. There is a material risk, we believe, that the insurance industry, wealth management industry, will be swept up into some of these initiatives in a way which is not entirely appropriate, given the quite different nature of these businesses. So we think it's important for insurers to engage with this dialogue and to engage with the question of systemic relevance, because I think it has implications for how their businesses will be run going forward. So I'm going to hand over to Anthony now to walk you through some of our thoughts there specifically on the insurance sector.
Thanks, Jacob. So we're going to drill down now, as Jacob said, on the implications for insurance and wealth. And a lot of the material that I'm going to present now was taken from a paper that the Geneva Association, which is an organization of the sponsored by the CEOs of some of the world's largest insurance companies, issued earlier this year in response to some of the output from the Financial Stability Board. So if you want to read more about that, then please go and grab that paper. It's quite a good one. So the FSB late last year set out a number of criteria to try and put some structure around how we might assess whether an institution is systemically relevant or not. They set out three main criteria, which are the first three that you can see up there. So the size of an institution. So essentially, not just the size of the balance sheet, but the volume of transactions that it undertakes, the nature of its counterparties, and so on. So just generally how big a company is. The second one was around substitutability. If that institution were to fall over, how easily could someone else or some other part of the sector come in and replace what they do? And you can imagine that from a systemic perspective. If somebody else can quickly step in and replace the services that an institution currently provides, then the risk of that then infecting the entire system is much lower. Whereas if they were a monopoly, for example, or had a significant part to play in a particular subsector, then there's a much greater risk, if they were to fall down, that they would take a lot of other institutions with them. Clearly, interconnectedness is related to that and is really trying to describe how much one institution has an impact on another. And we'll go into a little bit more of that later on in terms of the insurance sector, but I think it's pretty clear for all of you who are actually working in the system that you do deal with many other parts of the financial services sector and with the real economy in a number of different ways. But the question there is how, again, how strong are those linkages and in what way do those linkages actually apply?
The FSB set out three other, what they called contributing factors, which could increase or decrease the impact of an event. First one is leverage. So what kind of amplification is contained within an individual institution's balance sheet? So are they set up in such a way that a small event that impacts them turns into a large event for their customers and counterparties? Second one is around liquidity and large mismatches. So how big an impact would there be if they were no longer able to access liquidity? How much are they reliant on liquidity, and what's the nature of that liquidity? The third one is complexity, which I guess is a kind of catch-all of, you know, how easy or hard would it be to actually unpick what's going on within an individual institution in times of stress. Now, the IAIS, the body of insurance regulators, has added an additional factor to this, which you can probably see is one that is quite relevant for insurance to try and differentiate it from the banking sector, which is around timing. So over what time frame does the impact of any shock play out? And I think it's probably pretty obvious that banks have a much shorter time frame for most of the activities that they do compared to the insurance sector. Now, interestingly, there was a news report in the Financial Times late last year that suggested that the FSB had compiled a list of 30 systemically relevant financial institutions, and that list included five global insurers or reinsurers. Now, the FSB didn't confirm or deny that, but I think it's safe to say that that's probably a fairly accurate reflection of what's going on there. So that, I guess, was really the trigger for the insurance industry itself, the global insurance industry, to say, well, hang on a minute, are these criteria sufficient on their own, and how do they actually apply to the insurance industry and wealth management compared to banks? So I'm just going to go through each one now and give you a few thoughts on that. So first of all, in terms of size, if you look at most of the events that have happened to date, and the size of those within the financial services sector, by far the individual impacts to the likes of Lehman's and the overall banking sector during the GFC absolutely swamped even the worst kinds of impacts that have happened within the insurance and wealth sector. So if we think about natural catastrophe disasters and the impact on reinsurance and primary P&C insurers as being probably the area where the biggest issues have occurred, even the impact of Hurricane Katrina wasn't anything like the single default of Lehman's and the outstanding debt at the point that they defaulted. So I think the obvious conclusion there is that even the worst event that has happened to date on the P&C side hasn't been anything like a single event that's happened in the banking sector, let alone the GFC. And if you look at some of the company defaults that have happened in the insurance and wealth sector, Equitable Life in the UK, the overall impact, it's kind of hard to assess because it's more around lost benefits to members rather than an actual default as such, but the estimates are around £4.5 billion. So, you know, if you put that on the scale of events that have happened over the last 40 years, you know, that's a drop in the ocean compared to some of these other events. So I think the conclusion there is that although the insurance sector and the wealth sector is exposed to some very large single events, they're nowhere near enough, even on their own, to cause a systemic impact across the broader financial services sector. Another driver there is going beyond size and actually looking at the structure of the risks that institutions face. This is a few years old now, but the output of a study that we did for IFRI and the CRO Forum in Europe and shows the composition of economic capital by risk driver for the different types of banks and then for the insurance sector, life insurance, P&C and reinsurance. And again, you can see here that the range of different risks that the insurance companies are exposed to is much, much
broader and much more diverse than what the banks are exposed to, particularly around the commercial banking and retail banking. So, and not surprisingly, when there's a credit crunch, the institutions that are have high concentrations to credit risk as an overall risk type have suffered much more than the more diverse balance sheets and more diverse risk exposures that the insurance sector is facing. If we think about substitutability, and it's there's a number of different ways of trying to quantify substitutability. They're all fairly imperfect, but we had a go. The first one is just looking at net capital flows. And again, if we focus on large event reinsurance as being possibly the most systemic type of event to hit the insurance sector as a whole, now, clearly for life and wealth that's much less of an issue, but reinsurers play in both spaces and they provide risk cover to the life sector as well. It's very clear that even when we have had some of these significant events and capital has come out of the market in order to actually pay large claims, we've seen a lot of capital from other sources coming immediately back into the market. And so the reinsurance prices and the reinsurance sector has always been able to provide new capacity, even under some of the most significant events. Another way, perhaps, of looking at substitutability is around concentration. And we did try and run some numbers on the Australian market, and they essentially showed that there wasn't huge degrees of concentration in life, in wealth, and in P&C. And I guess those of you who have been following the NAB AXA bid, the ACCC has largely found the same thing. You know, the one area that they reported that they were concerned with two of the largest institutions in Australia merging was around platforms. So all of the other major product sides, they didn't seem to have a concern with those two institutions combining. So that would also suggest that the Australian market in particular is quite diverse, and therefore there's a reasonable amount of substitutability from one institution to the next. Interconnectedness. This is a great chart, which I'm sure some of you have seen already, to just demonstrate the meaning of interconnectedness, but also the significance of it. So the pigs crisis, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. This chart on the left-hand side just shows you how interconnected each of those countries are to other parts of the EU. So Italy, I mean, you know, a lot of focus has been obviously on Greece and Portugal, but if we go back to these underfunded pension schemes, Italy is the real elephant in the room from that perspective. You know, so they have exposures of 511 billion to France, and you can just see this kind of tangled web of how all of these different European countries are interconnected with each other, and why they're so concerned with the potential default of one of those. I think there was a Picasso painting that sold recently, broke a record for $100 million. Well, this picture's worth $1 trillion. And as our favourite spider Charlotte once said, that's some pig. If we think about the insurance and wealth sector, clearly there are a lot of areas where we are interconnected with other parts of the financial services sector, as well as beyond that. So, you know, we have asset management activities, which means that we deal in we interact in the bond market, the equity markets. We carry out financial risk management, which means that we interact with derivative markets. Obviously, on the liabilities, our core policy holders are part of the real economy, so anything that happens to an insurance company has an impact on the real economy in that way. We have credit protection, both selling credit protection but also buying protection through reinsurance and so on. Clearly, we have capital and funding and liquidity management needs, which means we use financial markets to intermediate between us and our investors.
And then the broader range of risk transfer activities such as insurance-linked securities and so on. So there's a vast array of different ways in which the insurance sector interacts, both with the financial sector but also with the real economy. And I think one of the key things here is even if we say that, well, most of the regulation is occurring on the banking side and therefore doesn't affect us directly, there's certainly a concern around collateral damage, as Jacob suggested, in terms of regulation impacting on the insurance sector inappropriately. But also, you all interact with banks in different ways. And so anything that affects the banks through regulatory chains is likely to affect the market and the environment in which the insurance companies are operating. So there are lots of second-order effects that could actually be quite significant. To give an indication of the size and the magnitude of this interconnectedness, on the insurance side, if you look globally at the amount of reinsurance that insurers carry out globally, it's a much, much smaller part of their overall risk exposures compared to the CDS transactions on the banking side. Now, it's not to say that they're not important, and if a Swiss Re were to go under, then that would clearly have implications for most of the world's insurers. But the size of the impact is probably likely to be less, and it may also be more contained than if the CDS markets were to freeze up. And of course, it's not to say that the insurance sector itself hasn't suffered during the global financial crisis. There have been a number of insurers who have gotten themselves into various forms of difficulty. Although I think it's fair to say that most of the big impacts that we've seen among the insurance sector have actually been in non-core activities, or have been where they've either been acting as banks or where they've been part of a bank insurance conglomerate, and it's been the banking side that has caused most of the problems. So those companies that have got very limited or no banking activities or bank-like activities have had very little state support compared to those companies that have been involved in wholesale banking activities of one form or another, so providing credit protection and so on. And, of course, the credit monoliners right at the far end, where the actual existence of that as a business has been called into question. And so, you know, we've had the likes of ING and Aegon getting support from the Dutch government. The Hartford in the US saw their share price drop to something like 5% of its prior value, which was a lot to do with hedging concerns and a few other interesting bits and pieces buried deep within those companies. But on the whole, the insurance sector, in its core insurance activities, has come out fairly well. And even AIG, we obviously had to have a slide on AIG, even AIG's troubles were actually caused by them acting effectively as a bank, providing credit insurance or essentially writing CDSs through a regulatory arbitrage structure, which meant that they found the most benign regulator they could in order to carry out those activities. And you can see that the FP, the financial products arm, it, by revenue back in 2005, was actually a tiny part of their global business. 3% of their revenues came from that. But if you see then what happened in 2008, then clearly that was what blew them up. And even there, it was quite an interesting chain of events. It essentially caused a liquidity crisis within AIG. So it wasn't a solvency problem, it was a liquidity problem. They had calls on collateral. A lot of the collateral had been invested in illiquid assets. They couldn't realize those assets. Therefore, the whole AIG system froze up. They couldn't or wouldn't take cash out of any of the solvent operations, hence the trouble. The timing point, I think, is also quite an important one. Obviously, the kinds of activities that insurers
are involved in tend to play out over a much longer time period than the banking side. So on the left is just a chart that we took from disclosures of one of the UK insurers, Friends Provident, which shows how the time frame over which their profits emerge, so the long time frame of their liability exposures. So any impacts in the short term aren't necessarily going to cause a cash crisis for a company like that. It might cause a solvency crisis, of course, but even a solvency crisis may well be manageable through that long time period. And even things like the World Trade Center, which is I guess seen as a much shorter term event, we're still playing out over a number of years in terms of the actual claims made, let alone the cash paid. So if we look at a kind of tick or cross scorecard in terms of how these criteria would apply to the insurance sector, I think size is not really an issue in terms of the insurance sector creating systemic risk. In some respects, it's actually a benefit because you get greater diversification of risks. Substitutability, there seems to be very few areas where an individual player within the insurance sector wouldn't be able to be substituted out if they got into trouble. And the impact of a single company getting into trouble is unlikely to cause a major disruption. Certainly interconnectedness is an issue. It may be more of an issue in terms of insurers being impacted by systemic events rather than causing them, but it's still a major issue that that we all should be aware of. Some of these other contributing factors definitely are also relevant. Leverage, maybe not so much, unless you're writing lots of guarantees and backing them with high yield or high risk assets. Certainly complexity and opacity have always been big challenges for insurance companies and wealth managers. Liquidity can get you into trouble in a lot of very specific areas if you actually start to think about it. But again, they're mostly specific to an individual institution rather than being a systemic problem. And then finally, timing. Timing tends to work in your favor rather than work against you in terms of any contribution to a systemic event. So just very finally, what are the implications? If we come back to this slide, I think it's quite an important one. There are a number of activities that could either contribute to or could be impacted by systemic events. And so it's very important, I think, for the risk management operations within an insurance company to really understand how they're exposed to each of these things and what kind of external events could trigger a problem within your institution, and even better if you can come up with some leading indicators so you can actually track how these external risks might be playing out and put in place risk mitigation as appropriate before it becomes a big issue. And we certainly saw in the UK a number of the big life insurers who have got significant guaranteed books were able to actually hedge out a lot of the risks at what now look like pretty good prices. At the time, they looked reasonably expensive. So Prudential actually chopped off the tail of a lot of its credit risk before the credit crunch really blew up. Aviva put in place some equity hedges as well. So the message here is you are exposed to a lot of broader systemic risks, but on the whole, you're likely to be the victims of them rather than the causes. So what should you do? First of all, look beyond your core risks. If we think back to the AIG example, it wasn't the things that were being closely monitored that got them into trouble. It was the small business on the side that was making a tiny incremental profit that actually got them into trouble. We know that some companies got into trouble with their stock lending businesses because they took the collateral expecting the stock lending to be rolled over. It didn't get rolled over. They had to come up with the funds, they'd invested the collateral in illiquid assets to try and get an uptick on the yield. So really be forensic around looking at the types of activities that wouldn't normally be scrutinized. Okay. Understand how you're interconnected with the broader financial services system and understand the impact of the current reforms as well. articulate your liquidity and capital strategy. In particular, make sure liquidity is in there, not just capital. Risk appetite statements are a great way of trying to make this a bit more real and actually getting the attention of senior management. And then finally, actually engage in this regulatory process. Don't just say, well, that's happening on the banking side, doesn't affect us, we're going to continue on merrily. It will affect you in a number of different ways, and so it's very important that you engage in that now. Okay, the ding has dung, so I'll...
Thank you, guys. That was a fascinating talk. If I could actually just kick things off. It's a really interesting talk on systemic risk, but what should it mean for us in Australia? For example, I don't know whether you want to comment on it, but I actually do worry about the funds management industry here in terms of if you're not part of a conglomerate, then the capital levels are actually low or non-existent. I'm actually really curious about whether that's a significant systemic risk for us within Australia. And I'll kick off, and while you're answering that question, I'll come around. I think I have to multi-skill. There's no institute staff here, so...
Well, I think the funds management industry does clearly have some risks within it. A lot of those are operational risks, and I think I understand there have been some discussions around whether mutual funds or unit trusts and so on should be holding capital, and I think that would make sense. I think from a broader perspective, whenever an institution is relying on revenue from one part of its business to support risks in another part of its business, then it needs to take that into account. And we often hear that, I think from a lot of players who are doing third-party management business, well, we don't hold the risks. Those risks are our clients rather than ours, and therefore we don't look at them. And I think that's a dangerous way of thinking about this, because you are exposed to risk from the revenue of that, and that will have an impact on your financials very clearly.
Thanks, Anthony. And if we can take questions from the floor, if I can ask you to state your name and organisation first.
Thanks, Mark Schneider. I think this is an incredibly complex area, especially with all the interconnectedness, but I think it's being made even more complex with the changes in technology. For example, we saw last week, I think it was, when automated trading systems kick in through some event, and suddenly it's not just one institution selling, it's many institutions selling, and they're selling at the speed of light, literally, and the stock markets can fall very dramatically. So I think there are two areas that need to be considered. One is the pace of change in all of this, so you can't look at what's happening just now, but where it's heading. And secondly, will the organisation have the time to react in the way they think they will? They may very well not have time to react, so they need to put plans in place, assuming, you know, that they can't react in 1 second.
I would absolutely agree with those comments, Mark. I think I would add that another thing that comes out of those observations around the risks that technology creates and the still unexplained events of last week is that it's important to have consistent standards and consistent regulation across different parts of the financial sector that interact together. So one of the hypotheses around what caused those events in terms of that rapid drop on the American Stock Exchange is that it was the existence of many different trading platforms that had slightly different rules and slightly different reactions to different types of market events that interplayed with each other in unexpected ways. And I think the fact that each of those platforms was able to go its own way in making decisions that ended up having systemic relevance is clearly cause for concern.
Do we have any more questions? Oh, sorry, down the front.
Get your exercise for
the day.
Sorry.
Just a different angle from systemic risk, and that is while an individual institution might not be considered systemically important, the behaviours of all those institutions in the same way can become very systemically important. And I was just wondering your view about who should be monitoring that process, and then how should they be engaging, if there is, with the institutions to steer a path away from, you know, the disaster.
I think when you think about the supervision of institutions, you can look at prudential regulation as being macro-prudential and micro-prudential, with the macro-prudential being a focus on the overall stability of the system, which in Australia is a responsibility of the Reserve Bank. And this is, in many cases, a gap in the regulatory architecture, as I referred to earlier. I think that that you're absolutely right that macro systemic risks can arise from the correlated behaviours of a large number of institutions which themselves might not be systemically important. And I think that requires coordination between whichever entity is responsible for regulating each of those institutions at a micro level, paying attention to make sure each individual institution's behaviour is sound, but it also requires a body which is responsible for looking at how everything fits together. So it's not just saying what are the most systemically relevant 30 or 35 institutions. It's what are all the different types of risk that individually or in aggregate can threaten our system, and ensuring that we have regulatory frameworks that are sufficiently flexible or sufficient coordination between different bodies that we can respond to those different threats appropriately.
Okay, I might just add one now. I'm curious about the G20 changes and whether they're in fact going to create future systemic risks, which we haven't really sort of anticipated yet. One area that I actually worry about is the development of clearinghouses for credit default swaps. Potentially they're going to be massive institutions in the next few years. I don't know whether there's any other potential systemic risks coming out of the current changes. I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that.
You can have that one as well.
When you began that question, I thought that my answer was going to be clearinghouses. Then you bit me to that one. I think that is clearly a key risk in that essentially we are transferring a large number of risks to individual institutions. I would imagine that there will be some pretty strong regulations around how those institutions are run, and I think there will clearly be implicit or explicit government support behind those institutions. So in many ways, it does make sense, I think, to concentrate risks in particular institutions where you can control their activities. So I think that's probably the key one. I think the other area of risk is where will all of the risk-taking go that we're stamping out of the banking system in particular? So if you look at the Volcker rule in the US, the removal of a lot of proprietary trading activities from the large banks' business portfolios, there's still going to be demand from investors for employing managers to take those kinds of risks for them. That will migrate into the unregulated sector, we believe, and that sector could become even bigger than it is now and pose a threat in and of itself.
Thank you, guys. Do we have any more questions?
Thank you. It's Martin Hicklin. I was just wondering if you might be able to expand a bit more on the unfunded pensions and how you see that playing out as a systemic risk, like how that would arise as an issue, and I suppose with regard to the time frame as well, is that one thing that can be worked out over a period of time?
So we think that this is an issue that exists in both the defined benefit and defined contribution world. So if you look at the pension liabilities of large corporations and governments, particularly in Europe, but also in North America and parts of Asia, there is a very substantial gap between the assets that they need in order to be able to meet the forthcoming liabilities and what they actually have. That gap, the size of it varies quite dramatically based on where the markets are. So last time we estimated this, the gap, this was last year, early last year, was around $2 trillion. And that will now have shrunk somewhat given the return of the equity markets. But it's it is significant, and that is something that will probably play out over the short term. I think there is a longer term risk around government pensions in general and the defined contribution schemes of the type that we have in Australia, that when we reach a point where dependency ratios have doubled, as they are expected to do over the next 20, 30 years, when we reach that point, either the state will be unable to pay all of its claims, or the savings of the individual investors who have been saving via defined contribution schemes like a superannuation will be insufficient to support their standard of living, and that will create great drains on the public sector finances. So we think it's both a long and a short-term threat, and it will most likely end up sort of concentrating greater risk in the public sector and causing further deterioration to public finances.
Yes, I've often heard of British Airways being referred to as a pension fund with an airline attached to it. I think the unfunded pension liabilities in the UK in particular are cause for real concern. Now, we've got time for one more question. If there's anybody out there, yes?
Rizwan Ali from ING. We talk about really large organisations which are called too big to fail, and you could think that there may be additional risk-taking activity within those organisations because of that knowledge that they've been sort of given that title. Do you know of anything that's being done to counter that sort of side effect of what these organisations have become?
Why don't you take that one?
I think the Volcker rule in the US is the best example there. So the concept that you have large institutions which are systemically important, and they know they're systemically important. They're running trading activities which are based on a cost of capital which is related in some ways to their role in the system, and their initiative is to pull those activities out and make sure they don't take them on. But I think that might be just the beginning in terms of the thinking of regulators about that. I think the living wills process going on in the UK might create more push to separate out some of those activities.
And just to add to that, some of the IMF discussion recently around applying taxes, for example, to the size of balance sheets and so on, which, again, the insurance sector as a whole has tried to push back on quite strongly. But if you look at the rules that they've suggested around actually getting access, this is a pre-funded bailout scheme, essentially, and the rules that they're trying to place around actually getting access to the funding are pretty onerous, and they're trying, I guess, to make it as nasty as possible for you to have to actually access those funds. So yes, you might be too big to fail in terms of your ultimate counterparties and so on, but it's going to be a pretty ugly process to actually get that money, and for the institutions themselves are not going to survive in their existing state. So that's I think is probably the best approach we've seen so far in terms of trying to mitigate some of that moral hazard around the too big to fail.
Well, thank you. Can we thank Anthony and Jacob in the usual way?